Welcome back to The Horse Race, your weekly look at politics, policy, and elections in Massachusetts. I'm Steve Cazella, president of the Massing Polling Group.
And I'm Jennifer Smith, and I am torn about this winter weather because it was like 30 degrees warmer yesterday.
It was, but does that mean like you might be in favor of it and you might be opposed to it or like undecided?
No, I'm a decided winter voter. I'm pro winter. I'm just not pro erratic winter because I don't know how to dress for it.
I see. So in favor of winter conditionally.
I just want it to commit. I just want winter to commit. I want winter to be running.
I see. This is like when you haven't announced yet, but you've announced that you're considering forming an exploratory committee.
This is an exploratory committee for winter, and I want it to run.
I see. Okay. Well, I'm guessing that sometime in the next month or two, we'll get a solid announcement, and then we will all regret it.
Because, that's true. You
know, that's how it happens.
Oh, man.
So we're here today on, I think for us, one of the biggest polling days of the year, which makes me happy and warms my heart.
Congratulations, polling season.
We have New Hampshire primary polling out this morning, and also we released a huge transportation poll, which we're actually going to talk about in the second segment today. But up here at the top, we have some highlights from the New Hampshire poll, which we released for WBUR.
Yeah, let's run through that. Who's in the lead?
Yeah, so we did both the Democrats and the Republicans in terms of primary polling in New Hampshire. On the Democratic side, we found a couple candidates sort of clustered up at the top. We found Pete Buttigieg with 18%, Joe Biden with 17%, and Bernie Sanders with 15%. Those are kind of the three closest to the top. And then Elizabeth Warren with 12%. So also sort of in that top tier, but not quite right up there, bunched up for the lead, I guess you could say.
Well, so what's the read on that then? I know a lot of people have been looking kind of at New Hampshire and Iowa in the context of, yes, these are the first in the nation. There's always the question about whether or not they're representative of a lot of the Democratic Party right now. But the other conversation is often about whether or not Warren's lead, which seemed to really be building, is softening now. So what's that look like here?
Yeah, I think that they're representative of elements of the Democratic Party. I mean, white liberal voters are a big part of the Democratic Party, but that's the element of it that Iowa and New Hampshire are representative of. So we look within the numbers, so who within New Hampshire are supporting each of the candidates. And there we find big divides by age, education, gender. They're just very different candidates that different groups are supporting. Joe Biden does the best, I think, to nobody's surprise, among older voters. And you look across the age groups and it steps down and down and down from in the 30s among the oldest voters down to like 2 or 3% among voters under 30. And the opposite thing happens when you look at Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and interestingly, Andrew Yang also does very well among younger voters, or 15%. I guess he does well among younger voters. Mm-hmm. But then he also sort of steps down to almost no support among the primary's older voters.
Right. And one of the other candidates that obviously has been making a big play for his neighboring state of New Hampshire is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. How's he looking?
Right. So Bernie Sanders is certainly up there in the top group. He has 15% and is doing much better among younger voters. So he, Warren, and Yang are in pretty tight competition for those younger voters. But the particularly interesting candidate in terms of age or the one who stands out in a certain way is Pete Buttigieg. And the reason for that is that unlike these other candidates who do see their support either really increase or just fall off a cliff as you move up the age categories, his is pretty steady. He doesn't really, and actually that extends to education and gender as well. His support is relatively even across the demographic groups that we examined. That's very different than the other candidates who are appealing to really specific slices of the Democratic Party and really competing with certain other candidates for that slice that they're trying to occupy.
And so you're our polling expert. What does this mean going into New Hampshire? What lessons should we take away from this?
Well, I think that you also pointed out that Warren's support seems to be softening, and that does seem to have happened. We'd never know for sure whether we're witnessing part of a trend or the end of a trend or the reversal of a trend. But we can say for sure that her support now is lower than it was maybe a month ago or so. So I think that's a useful reminder that the candidate of the moment may not be the candidate of the next moment. We can think back to primaries sort of in the recent past, recent cycles, where we've seen that strongly. You know, the 2012 Republican primary, for instance, we saw Michelle Bachmann, we saw Rick Perry, we saw Herman Cain. You know, they all sort of came and went.
And then that fade happened very fast.
Right. And Mitt Romney was sort of bumping along at the top the entire time. So this, in some ways, reminds me of that, where you've had, you know, Elizabeth Warren had a big spike, and that seems to have softened somewhat. Pete Buttigieg is either at the top or somewhere in the midst of a big spike. Will that last? There's still, you know, a number of weeks to go left before the New Hampshire primary actually happens. Is there still time? You know, is there time for one of the other candidates to catch fire and sort of have that moment? And of course, does their peak happen to coincide with when voters are actually making their decisions? Because obviously that's what you want.
That's right. And of course, there are Republicans running. So what's
going
on
here? Yes, there are Republicans running. Bill Weld, former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, and Joe Walsh are both running on the Republican side against Donald Trump. Donald Trump has a gigantic lead. You know, he's got 74%, Bill Weld at 9%, Joe Walsh at 4%. That's Trump's support's maybe not as high as I would have thought. I was sort of expecting 80s, you know, even high 80s. So 74% is not as strong as I might have
thought. Well, the other thing, too, is I know it's a joke that journalists can't do math, but I can do math enough to know that 70-something plus 4 plus 9 does not equal 100. So how are other people feeling?
Yeah, so there's still some undecideds on both sides. You know, there's still some who say they're undecided or say that they choose some other candidate. I suppose there's still some hope that someone else might get in the race up there for some voters. But the other thing just about the number of undecideds is there's really more undecideds than that, particularly on the Democratic side. Because voters who say, you asked me about right now who I would vote if the election were today, and this is who I'd vote for, but I still might change my mind. You know, we can see that voters have changed their mind because Elizabeth Warren's support is lower than it was and Pete Buttigieg's is higher than it was. So, you know, we know that voters change their minds. So I think particularly in a primary, the number of undecideds is always higher than it actually looks.
Gotcha. All right. Well, we're gonna go back to this as it continues to cycle ever closer to the New Hampshire primary and all the other primaries. There's a million primaries. We'll get there. But why are we here right now? In the new bunker?
Question. Yes, that's right. We didn't even make that announcement. We are in our new pod bunker. Awkwardly trying to figure out like where we're all going to sit and where the microphone should go and why there's no vent in here. So we're
just playing
suffocating.
Like bunker Tetris, trying to figure out where everything fits. But we'll get there.
We will. But today we're here. We actually have a big transportation episode for you. We have Boston Globe reporter Adam Vaccaro in to talk about a bunch of stuff related to the MBTA, but particularly that big new safety report that they issued this week, talking about safety culture and sort of the T's approach to safety in general.
The scale. Scathing report about the MBTA.
It's a fair characterization.
Yeah. And then we're going to talk to, hey, surprise, you, Steve, and also Rich Parr about the Transportation and Climate Initiative, because you folks have done some great policy polling on that. So let's talk transit, shall we?
It's been a tough few weeks for the MBTA. The Orange Line has struggled mightily. The Green Line had to shut down at Park Street yesterday, and a disconnected train car at South Station shut down a portion of the commuter rail. The rest of the system has also continued to struggle. Then this week, a report ordered by the MBTA finds serious safety concerns. Here to discuss what that report means for the future of the T and its passengers is Boston Globe transportation reporter Adam Vaccaro. Adam, welcome back.
It's always fun to be here.
Talking about trains.
Fun.
I feel there's some sarcasm there.
A little bit. I mean, so Adam, we know how stressful it can be just to depend on the T for our daily commutes. I can imagine it, but I'm no longer in this position. But the pain of actually covering it day to day must be a hazard. Our condolences to you. Thank you so much for being here. So let's talk about this safety report.
Let's do it.
All right. So what actually prompted it, and how was the team behind it put together?
Well, Jen, as a Dorchester resident, you may recall that the Red Line had a little bit of a problem this summer.
It went off the rails, as I recall.
It went off the rails.
That's a figure of speech, right?
Oh, into the signal boxes. Crashed into
Not
signal
a figure
boxes.
Of speech. Okay.
It went off the rails for a few hours and then wiped out, you know, the system for weeks on end, essentially. And so in the aftermath of that, the T's board ordered a a review, basically, top to bottom of safety practices at the agency. They brought in some pretty big names for it, including Ray LaHood, the former U.S. Transportation Secretary. And they took a few months, wrote up what they wrote up, and came back with it on Monday.
So give us the short version. What were some of the key highlights of what they found?
Basically, the TE isn't doing enough to get up out ahead of potential safety issues. There are staffing reasons for that. There have been training reasons for that. There have been sort of a lot of organizational, deep in the weeds, how you factor safety into your culture and your training reasons. There are also some more practical ones. Most obvious, perhaps, in the last couple of weeks, Orange Line trains, the old ones, the ones that we are still relying on from the 1980s, the maintenance on those has just been really poor. And the panel suggested that part of the reason for that is that the T is basically crossing its fingers and waiting for the new ones to come in. We are seeing that play out in real time right now. Orange Line trains across the system have been breaking down. And while we're waiting for those, you know, highly hyped new trains, they're actually slow to enter service and right now haven't been on the tracks for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, well, actually, one of the lines that really struck me, horrified me, was, quote, "In essence, safety is not the priority at the T, but it must be." So how is it that you end up in a situation where the public transit for the region is not the priority? How can safety not be integrally connected there?
Yeah, you know, the report does have some pretty scathing language. It also goes out of its way to say the T is relatively safe. And the panel that wrote the report on Monday stressed that transit is still safer than basically any other mode of transportation. So they did want to make that clear, but indicated that the T just hasn't had its eye on the safety ball as much as it could have. A lot of people, including you, Steve, I know, have spent a lot of time looking at the way the T works with its budget, basically taking whatever it can scrap up as savings from the operating budget, including money that is dedicated toward operations from the legislature each year, and instead throwing it into capital improvements. Those capital improvements are things like new subway trains, new signal systems, the type of things that, you know, in theory, eventually, should lead to better service that we've all been wanting. And nobody's saying that shouldn't, you know, still be a priority, because fixing the T is like tantamount to this region's continued success, most people would argue. But in putting the focus there and taking away money from operating, it seems like it's allowed a lot of safety functions to sort of go unaddressed, or at least not fully addressed.
What are some of the solutions then? I mean, I'm guessing that it's not just a matter of money, although I do want to come back to that in a little bit. What are some of the things that the panel recommended that the T should be doing, and how are they being received so far?
The T basically took it in stride, and it should be noted that the report was ordered by its own board, so they're not really contesting the findings. They've mostly been gracious and said, okay, these are things we'll do, and we must do, and we will do. A lot of them are going to cost money. Some of them, maybe not so much. There's a lot of things like every contractor or employee who comes to work for the T has to go through a training. The panel found, for example, that the trainers were writing the answers to tests on the board, on like a chalkboard or a whiteboard or whatever, so that people could consult that during the test. And so they said, you know, you probably shouldn't be doing that. Things like that.
It feels like it doesn't require much expertise.
I was going to say, I wish the people doing this at the MBTA were in charge of my law school exams. That sounds great.
It definitely gives a little bit of a leg up, I'd say, and probably isn't, you know, forcing people to digest this information as much as possible. A few other things in there would include, trimming trees and vegetation along the tracks. Not a major matter of funding, but something that if gone unaddressed can result in vehicle damage or issues on the tracks or track fires. That was something that the panel said is low-hanging fruit that the T had basically let lapse. The funding for that has since been restored, the report said. There, a lot of other things were sort of setting up metrics that basically, you know, it sounds so jargony, but basically performance indicators about safety. And they weren't really specified what they should be necessarily, but things that would allow the T to be more proactive in its maintenance to avoid these issues going forward.
But one big thing as well that the report noted, it looked like, was sort of the issue of A, morale in general around how they felt about the status, repair, safety. And another one where the frontline staff was saying they didn't even feel fully able to report safety concerns to management. So what was just kind of the report saying about how people are feeling inside the MBTA and what can be done about that?
Yeah, there was definitely a sense that people on the front lines felt like they weren't being listened to. And in fact, the report even found that there were, you know, more than 1,000 sort of defects along the tracks. And it turned out that the T had already logged many of those, which sort of just indicated that even though employees were picking them out, staff wasn't or management wasn't really responding to it. There were also recommendations in the report that the T needs to sort of set up a you know, no fault, safe place type of hotline where employees can feel free to just let their safety concerns go. Apparently, that's lacking today.
So one of the things that the legislature has indicated that they're looking at for sort of the next few months or sometime within the session apparently is just the question of overall resource levels for the T. Does this report change that conversation at all, or was this already kind of factored into what legislative leaders thought the T needed?
Yeah, one branch of the legislature, at least we should say. The Senate hasn't really committed to taking this up while the House has. I think that this sort of bolsters the conversation there. House leaders seem to be saying that this is just more evidence that we need to pursue this. That said, we're sitting here on Wednesday at, 1:30, 2 o'clock?
At 2 o'clock.
I think there's 1 hour left for the House and Senate to reach an agreement on a year-end funding provision that includes $50 million for the T that Governor Baker says is sort of necessary to help fund these safety initiatives. And it doesn't seem obvious that they're going to pass that. So I know that there's a little bit of a question in the air about whether if they can't get that through, can they do anything bigger in the weeks to come?
And then, of course, DeLeo has pushed the matter of transportation financing sort of to 2020. So what happens in the meantime?
I think that the governor would point to that $50 million. Other than that, I think the T would have to sort of prioritize for some of the short term or high priority safety issues and start focusing on those, perhaps juggling resources the way that the back the other direction from what the report indicates they had been doing previously.
So you're the Boston Globe's transportation reporter, so I also have to ask you about another issue which has been in the headlines recently, which is the T's new fare collection system, which was going to enable you to do things like pay with your phone and enable the T to do things like charge different people different amounts in different places and so forth, you know, sort of integrate the subway and the commuter rail. It sounds like that's going to be delayed now and cost a whole heck of a lot more money. So what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a really high-profile project at the T basically since 2016, pretty early on after the control board took power there. And it seemed like it was going to happen pretty quickly. We were going to get this brand spanking new fare collection system modeled off the one in London, which is, you know, pretty well regarded. Pretty quickly, it was supposed to be running pilot tests by now, going into place starting early next year and be all wrapped up by 2021. Looks like that's actually going to be 2024 and a much slower rollout. Although we'll start seeing parts of it as early as 2021, 2022, the system won't be fully implemented until 2024. And we're talking at least $160 million more, and that might reach far higher than that.
All right. Well, Adam Vaccaro with the Boston Globe, thank you so much for, I assume, taking the long, slow commute into our offices today to talk with us.
I could walk, so not so bad.
It's a big polling day here at the horse race. Like we mentioned up top, WBUR issued a new poll on the New Hampshire primary this morning. And also out this morning is what Steve tells me is the largest poll they have ever conducted. And this is a policy poll, so it covers a new proposal called the Transportation and Climate Initiative, which would cap carbon pollution from transportation and invest in transportation improvements. To talk about this, we have not one, but two pollsters with us today.
Lucky us.
Steve, you're one of them. You don't get to say lucky us.
Hey. You know, I feel that we're lucky to have me on board.
So both Steve, who feels lucky to have himself on board, and also Mass Inc. Polling's Research Director, Rich Barr. Hi, Rich.
Hi, guys. How are you?
We're all right. So let's start with the basics. Rich, what would this policy actually do?
This policy is called the Transportation and Climate Initiative. And what it would basically do is set a cap on the amount of carbon emissions that could be generated by transportation across the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states. And over time, that cap would go down. Fuel companies that import fuel into the region would have to pay basically allowances to pollute based on how much pollution their fuels would generate. And then the proceeds from the sales of those allowances would be distributed to the states, and the states could use them for various improvements to transportation or to make their transportation systems more resilient to climate change, to encourage people to use more environmentally friendly ways of getting around, so on and so forth. It's based on a policy that's been in place in the electricity generating sector in the region for some time. And if you've ever had one of those mass save home energy audits in Massachusetts, where they come and give you insulation or new windows, or you get a new furnace or something like that, that is funded by the power generating equivalent of what this program would do to the transportation sector.
Gotcha. And so this is a collaboration between 12 states and the District of Columbia, right?
That's correct. So as I understand it, Transportation and Climate Initiative comprises those 12 states. A subgroup of them has been working on the details of this policy, and it'll be up to each state to decide whether they want to participate or not.
Gotcha. Okay, so Steve, let's talk about the poll. What's the story behind it, and what questions were you guys looking to answer?
Yeah, so the poll is of the region, and just to sort of set the parameters of what we're talking about, the region pretty much extends from Virginia at the far south all the way up through Maryland, Pennsylvania, New York, all the way through New England, and all the way up to Maine. So what we wanted to do is poll the states, since again, as Rich pointed out, the states will be the ones deciding if they want to participate, and find out if we describe something like this fairly complex policy, but if we describe it to people, what would the support levels be in each state? So that sort of the whole region's less interesting, but support levels in each state is what we were really looking to find out. So when we did that, we found that, roughly speaking, support levels vary between about 60% at the low end, up through sort of the low 70s at the high end. So all across the region at the state level, the biggest states that were participating in TCI, Transportation and Climate Initiative, we found net support for the policy when we described it.
Gotcha. And so you actually asked some of these voters that you polled to rate several potential uses for the funds that would be generated by the program. What were you seeing as far as responses?
Yeah, so that's a key element to the program also, which is it's not just about the fee that gets assessed. It's that then the states can sort of decide what they want to do with the funds. So what we saw is that the needs are different across states, not surprisingly. And even within regions within states, needs are different. So when you sort of think of the geography moving down that region, places like Boston, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and New York all had a lot of interest in transit uses, for instance. We saw transit high sort of throughout the region, but particularly high in urban areas. We also saw the idea of protecting roads, bridges, and other infrastructure from climate change was high. And then you sort of go down the list to the very bottom, where we saw electric vehicles were actually the thing that people were the least interested in at this point.
So can you break down any of those variations across different states, for instance? How did Massachusetts, which we're in, feel about the TCI in general and the best way to spend that money?
Yeah, TCI in Massachusetts, we've polled a number of times. So this one, you know, Massachusetts was one of seven states that we did. But we've done other polls where we've included TCI sort of over the last year or two since this idea has sort of been in formulation, and found that support here has sort of been in the somewhere between mid-60s to low-70s, sort of in that range. So it's at the higher end of the seven states that we polled for this, but it also sort of resembles other polls that we've done. Rich, what would you say were some of the top things that residents here in Massachusetts were interested in?
It's basically what you said, Steve. The idea of doing something about public transit really popped here. So overall, across all of the taking kind of a weighted average of all these seven states, 81% of people supported the idea of using some of this money from this program to improve public transit in their state. In Massachusetts, it's 86%. So it really kind of rose to the top there. The idea of making the rest of the transportation infrastructure more resilient was also popular at 82%. And then making public transportation more affordable so that more people could use it, that was up there. That was also at 82%. So that was a little bit higher than the average for all of the seven states. I mean, it is interesting that, you know, this is kind of consistent with stuff that we've found in our previous polling in Massachusetts about this program. People tend to support the idea of using this to improve the existing transportation infrastructure in one shape or form. they're a little bit less interested in, say, giving some of the money back to consumers as in the form of a rebate or in the form of maybe an incentive to buy an electric car or building more electric car charging stations. You know, when we've asked about electric cars in focus groups, we found that people kind of still think of them as sort of a far-off thing. They're not quite, you know, a mass market. There's not a mass market appeal out there. It's not like people are, you know, just waiting for their rebate check so they can go and get an EV instead of, you know, whatever they're driving right now.
Another thing that I wanted to ask either of you about was kind of the partisanship breakdowns that you may have seen in the poll. And the reason that I bring it up is I'm pulling from the State House News Service write-up of the poll right now. Wednesday, when we're recording, is kind of interesting because Governor Baker, his transportation secretary, and his energy and environmental affairs secretary plan to discuss TCI at a Wednesday event today with environmental and business groups. But then there was also a planned Wednesday press conference from some groups opposing it. So there is some kind of push back and forth on this. What were you seeing in the polls regarding who's for and who's against this?
Yeah, so the partisan split is sort of what you'd expect, where Democrats tend to be more supportive than Republicans of anything that will increase taxes on voters or consumers. But even among Republicans, we found support was still slightly over half. So, you know, it wasn't as though there was strong opposition. One of the things that groups have asked about this poll, particularly groups that are more likely to be opposed to TCI, were why we didn't talk more about the potential cost increase for consumers. Because one of the ways that this policy could work out is that there's a fee that's assessed to fuel importers into the region, and then they turn around and pass that along to consumers at the pump. So just to quickly address that, the reason that we didn't is because the question, as we wrote it, is meant to be the things that we know right now about the policy in the most sort of descriptive, vanilla way that we could ask it. We could have put in something like people have asked about, where it could have increased costs at the pump. However, we also could have put in things about, you know, how much money your state would get to improve public transportation, or, hey, what if it reduced congestion or something? You know, we could also have put in good elements. So at the moment, this is what we know about the policy. We don't know what the fee will be. We don't know what the potential cost increases could be. We don't know what the potential revenue could be. But there certainly are, I think, partisan elements or at least ideologically aligned elements within the different states that are looking at how this is going to impact consumers.
Right. And I think the last thing I kind of want to get to is the look ahead on this one. So what the actual conclusions are as far as how does the public feel about this? Do most of them know about the policy? And if they do they have strong opinions about that? And how might that kind of work out going forward as lawmakers kind of consider whether or not to implement it?
So at the moment, by name, so when you call it the Transportation and Climate Initiative, very low awareness. That's not necessarily surprising. We compared it sort of for our own interest to the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is the thing that funds MassSave. So people know MassSave, but do they know that there's something called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, where the funds come from? They don't. And that's been around since 2009. So when we name this new policy, TCI, and ask, so have you heard of this? People still have not heard of it. So the challenge with something like this is that you still have to, you have to describe it. You have to present it in a way where voters, to whatever extent you can reach, understand a common set of things about the policy that they're being asked to ask whether or not they would support or oppose. So that's what we tried to do here. You know, and when you describe as much as we know right now, that's the support levels you get. How the public debate plays out, we don't really know in terms of like what features voters might be reacting to. You know, that's something where we can sort of make our best guess. We can run messaging polls and see how voters react to different elements, but we don't specifically know like what will be emphasized and how voters will react. But Rich, why don't you sort of pave the road ahead for us, if you could, and just sort of tell us where this is going and what the next steps are.
So my understanding of this process is that at some point later this month, there's going to be an actual announcement from the states that are working on developing the details of the policy. And Massachusetts, I should say, is very much involved in that regional collaboration. The energy secretary for Massachusetts, Charlie Baker's energy secretary, is, I believe, the co-chair of this entire effort. So Massachusetts is quite invested. I think it's interesting. So we should get some more meat on the bones in terms of like what would the cap be? How much would it cost for these fuel companies to do these allowances? What might that generate in terms of revenue? How would that get split up among the states? What would it, if they pass that cost down to consumers, what would that mean to prices at the pump? You know, all of those are details that I think would be really helpful. We, you know, one of the reasons we didn't ask about some of that stuff in this poll is we simply just don't know where it is. And yet, I will say it also plays into an interesting thing that's happening in Massachusetts right now, because the legislature is trying to figure out something on transportation revenue in a more local sense, in a state level sense, whether to raise the gas tax, for example, or tolls or so on and so forth. And there's been some scratching of heads in the transportation committee. You know, Chairman Strauss has been sort of trying to get an answer. Well, how much is this TCI thing going to cost, and what's it going to raise? Because I would really like to know that before I start talking about raising the gas tax by 15 cents or 5 cents or 25 cents or whatever it is. So there's sort of a local political dynamic that's going to play in, as well as the regional dynamic. The legislature doesn't have to approve this. This is something that the governors of each state can kind of sign on to. But it obviously has implications, since it's going to mean a new stream of revenue coming into each state that could be, you know, replacing something else or supplementing something else that could be happening. So it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out in the next month or so, because the legislature is going to be kind of doing their own sort of parallel process on transportation here as well.
Gotcha. Well, Rich and Steve, thank you so much for breaking down TCI.
You're welcome.
All right, well, that brings us to the best moment of all of your day. We're confident that that's correct. And of course, that is time for horse race trivia. So last week, the question was, according to state law, how many bells do you have to attach to the harness in order to legally operate a sleigh in Massachusetts?
And apparently the answer is 3.
The answer is 3. There's a law for it.
I've got to shut down all of my illegal sleigh rides. That's a real shame. I was only using 2 bells.
Well, now you know before you got a ticket. We give a special shout out to State Rep Michelle Ciccolo, who was our first out of several correct answers we got on social media. So you get whatever it is that you get for winning horse
race trivia. 3 whole points for 3 whole bells on a properly done sleigh.
3 points is big. You can do a lot with that.
I hear.
So this week we actually have a mailbag question rather than trivia. And the question comes from our good friend and longtime listener, Ryan Naismith. And the question is, what would have happened in the Boston City Council race if the recount, which had gone down to only 1 vote difference, if that had actually been a tie? It was that close. It was 1 vote. Summarize what happened, just to remind people what we're talking about. And then you've done some research, some hard-hitting public service journalism about what would have happened if it had just been 1 vote different.
Yeah, every once in a while here at the horse race, we kind of take a tour through really patient representatives for various elections offices while I ask them really silly questions. But this one was interesting. So for background, as most of you may recall, unless your sense of time is so warped, we just had an election, and that actually ended here in Boston with a recount for the 4th slot on the at-large race. So that was between Julia Mejia and Alejandra St. Guillen. So initially, Mejia was up by a very, very small vote margin. And St. Guillen pushed for a recount, which, again, is reasonable within that amount of margin. And so after getting all of these signatures to go have a recount happen, and after days of actual recounting all of the votes across Boston, what we found was that the margin actually got a lot narrower. So Mejia came away victorious with 22,492 votes, and St. Guillen got 22,491
That's
votes.
Crazy. It literally was 1 vote.
Absolutely wild. So the question, of course, as Ryan asks correctly, is what happens if there had been like one vote there? Because for context, St. Guillen's not contesting it. Their team says, we think we actually probably could have pulled it out, but we're just going to let the stand. So he is going to go on to the council. But if there had not been that 1 vote difference, the answer that I found out was kind of like,
we hope
this doesn't happen. Yeah. So there is a state policy on this, because the Boston City Charter actually only has a policy with regard to a mayor's vote here. So the state answer is, if there's a tie, it's considered a failure to elect. That's if you're going by the state policy. And that just means you treat this spot like a vacancy. There's a difference between the vacancy for the mayor's election, which basically says, it's vacant, you have to hold a special election and fill that seat. So that's the mayor's state. But there isn't actually a comparable policy for the Boston City Council. Generally speaking, if there's a vacancy for the at-large seats, so these special four seats where you vote for multiple people across the whole city, generally, it's just whoever came in next on the ballot goes up and fills the vacancy. The reason this might sound familiar is because that is exactly what happened with Althea Garrison when Ayanna Pressley went to Congress. But in this case, it would actually be a little bit weird because you would be voiding the fourth and fifth spots and potentially sending the sixth place person in there, beating out two people who got more votes than them. So I was talking to the very nice representatives at the Secretary of the Commonwealth's office. And so apparently, if this ever happened, because Boston doesn't have a policy for this, it would just go to a judge.
And
there's no good answer
here. We have no idea how that
would be decided. We have no idea how that would shake out. So it sounds very simple. What happens if there's a tie? And the very short answer is chaos. Yeah.
All right. So, Ryan Naismith, thank you for sending us down that rabbit hole. And maybe we can, you know, maybe there will be some change to policy to clarify that.
Yeah.
But for now, that is all the time we have. So shameless plug time. If you're not subscribed to Stephanie Murray's Politico Massachusetts Playbook, obviously do that. Wherever you listen to us, go ahead and leave us ratings, reviews to help others find us. And if you have polls to do, give us a ring.
I am Jennifer Smith.
And I'm Steve Cazella, president of the Massing Polling Group. Our producer this week and every week is, of course, Libby Gormley. And thank you all for listening.